doesn't even understand it. It all seems so absurd. The droid drops back down into his chair with a rattle and tilts his head toward her, then says,
"You should speak to Master Temin now."
She does not say her son's name so much as it spills out of her. And broadcast from the droid's own speaker comes her son's voice? How? Bones has a proximity sensor, doesn't he? He must have turned it on when he landed on Jakku. Soon as Temin was close, the comms connected automatically. It fills her with light and life when her son says,
"Mom?"
Mom. That one word. She's missed hearing it so bad. "Kiddo," she says, her eyes burning hot with the threat of tears. "I've missed you, kiddo. Where are you? Are you in that X-Wing?"
"I'm so sorry, Mom. I didn't know. I almost shot you down. Please forgive me. Wait, what are you doing in an Imperial shuttle?"
But what does she tell him? Does she say that she found his father? The family reunion she longs to have is so close. They could rescue him together. And yet, this is dangerous territory. She's heading right into the heart of the Empire's occupation. She knows it seems awfully headstrong, but if she does this alone, maybe Temin won't follow and won't get hurt. At least in that X-Wing, he's got control, plus other pilots covering his tail. "Is Wedge with you?"
"He is."
"Thank the lucky stars."
"I can patch us over."
"No, I can't be on radio chatter. If the Empire picks up what I'm doing, Tem..."
"What are you doing?"
"I've got a lead on Sloane, and..." In that moment, she decides not to tell him about his father. She knows she may regret it later. But once he hears about Brenton, Temin will start acting with his heart and not his head. "I've stolen a shuttle. I've got clearance codes. I'm headed to the Imperial base past something called the Sinking Fields."
"We'll escort you in."
"No can do, kiddo. They see you on the scopes, they'll cut you to pieces. And maybe me, too." It pains her to say this, but she does. "You stay out here. Stay with Wedge. He'll keep you safe. Let him know I'm okay."
"Are you okay? Mom?"
"I am. I promise. I've got Bones with me. You did good with him. He already saved my life out here once."
"Land the shuttle, Mom. We can figure this out."
"It's a war zone, Tem. I can't land here. Neither can you." Ahead, she sees that the defensive line of the Empire's forces awaits. "You need to turn around. They have turrets, turbo lasers, mortars, walkers, TIEs, everything. Who knows what else? You don't want to get close to the base defenses. They see you, they might figure out who I am, too. Then we're both dead." She blinks back tears and pleads with him. "Please, turn around."
"Mom, wait."
"Temin, please, go."
"Promise I'll see you again."
"You'll see me again." It's a promise she doesn't know how she'll keep. She's not even sure she believes it herself. "We'll be a family again soon, okay? I love you, kiddo. Stay safe."
"Bones, you take good care of her."
"Roger, roger, Master Temin."
"I love you, Mom. Get Sloane. See you on the other side."
And with that, the blip disappears from her screen as her son pulls away from his pursuit of her shuttle. Chapter 29.
"No."
I'm sorry, what?" Sinjir asks.
"I said no, Sinjir,"
the Chancellor says.
"Ma, I see. We must be having a communication problem. I'm not Chandrillan, and though I believe we share the same crispness of wit, there must be some crucial language barrier I'm coming up against.
I have to assume that, because of my very good deeds rendered in service to the New Republic, that surely, surely, when I ask if I can go to Jakku to help my friends, your only answer would be an unqualified yes, Sinjir. Absolutely, Sinjir. Please, take this metal and also this bag of money, Sinjir.
Mon Mothma sits across from him. Her hands are steepled, though clearly the one is not functioning as well. It looks palsied the way it droops next to the other. She smiles over the bridge of her fingers, though, as if unfazed by it. Also as if unfazed by him.
Mr. Rothvelis, she says, I appreciate your consternation.
Do you? Truly?
But I cannot approve your journey to Jakku. You are not a soldier or a pilot, or an officer. You want your friends back, that I recognize. It is a noble desire, but one I cannot help you fulfill, I'm afraid.
Politics, he thinks. The only thing worse than politics is politicians.
He leans over, knowing full well he's not only crossing a boundary here, but frankly leaping over it, like a punted Gizka.
You listen here, Chancellor. I risked my neck and every other part of me for you. It took me a day just to get this meeting. And
if you want to go to Jakku, just go to Jakku.
What?
I can't stop you. Find a ship, get on it, fly it to that miserable war-torn desert world. You will drop right into the madness and probably be swatted like a pesty fly. But that's your trouble, not mine.
Fine. Yes, good. I will do exactly this.
She nods her head gently.
May the stars speed your journey.
He starts to get up, and she holds a finger in the air.
One more thing, though.
Hmm?
If you perish above Jakku, or on it, or anywhere near it, then you won't be able to take the job I'm offering you.
What heinous caper is this? He narrows his gaze to suspicious reptilian slits.
Job? I don't know anything about that.
Yes, because you haven't heard me offer it yet.
I'm sorry. Am I short-circuiting like a wet droid? What are we talking about here, exactly?
With her weaker hand, she gently gestures toward the chair. The message is clear. Sit and hear the offer, or go and do not.
Bloody hell, fine.
He sits down in the chair like an insolent schoolboy, slumping back, feigning disdain.
What's this job, then?
I need an advisor.
And you want me to find you one?
I want you to be one.
He brays with laughter.
What? Seriously?
But he sees on her face she is serious. Deadly so. He sits up straight, oddly embarrassed.
Oh, you actually mean it?
For the galaxy's sake, why?
Because you're very good at getting people to do what you want.
Frequently by bending their fingers back so far they break.
That's not a good look for a pacifist of your stature.
Her gaze matches his own. It's only now he realizes how properly intense she can be. He doesn't really know what the Force is or how it even works, except that she must possess it, given the way her gaze feels like a pair of tweezers picking him apart, atom by atom. She flexes her palsied hand as if to exercise it.
Yes, your reputation in that regard precedes you, Sinjir.
But another reputation is beginning to form and grow.
You are even more incisive with your tongue than you are with your violence. You can be alarmingly convincing, as evidenced by what you said to Senator Rethalo. And further, how you manipulated those senators into giving me their vote. I need someone like that. Oxy is a most excellent advisor in matters political. But I need a cynic. Someone who distrusts the system. Who maybe even despises it. And I also need someone who can play the game and get me what I want. that someone is you.
This is a joke, right?
A bit of a poke and tickle?
I say yes, and then from that potted plant and under this chair, a chorus of onlookers leap out and laugh. Because surely you aren't considering hiring an ex-imperial torture agent to advise you on running the entire civilized galaxy.
No joke. I don't have a very good sense of humor, anyway.
He sneers.
I hate politics.
So do I.
I hate politicians.
Good. So you can manipulate them to do your bidding.
He leans back, crossing his arms. One eyebrow up so far it's damn near in orbit. He says,
I get paid.
Handsomely.
I'll be on Nocadia or here on Chandrilla.
My primary office will remain on Chandrilla for now, though I will have a proper desk on Nocadia too.
A job offer. From the Chancellor. He has to chew that one a good bit. Of course he doesn't want it.
Pah!
The political realm is a grotesque circus, an erratic carousel drunkenly turning like a blindfolded child wielding a stick at his nativity party.
Sinjir's opinion of the whole charade.
Tear it all down. Burn it up. Dance among the ashes while swilling a bottle of something good. That's his take.
But then again,
maybe he ought to give another go at this stability thing. If he and Condor are trying again. If the war is truly almost over, and the crew is finally done.
What place does he have in the galaxy?
He confesses his only option right now is to sashay his narrow hind over to some distant cantina and see if he can't find himself a quiet corner in which to plant himself as the resident barfly. But he admires Condor. There's a man who wants to work. Who wants to do the right thing, and do it with skill and aplomb, and a smile bridging those fuzzy, adorable cheeks.
He deserves to be as impressed by me as I am by him. Maybe this is how I accomplish that.
I need time to think about it, he says.
You have 30 seconds.
I... what?
Decide now. I have to move quickly on this. Having a vacancy among my advisory duo has already hampered my ability to perform as Chancellor, and I do not want to wait. So the clock is ticking.
Chancellor?
20 seconds now.
Well...
let's call it 10.
It's not 10. You're speeding up the clock. That's cheating.
It is, but I'm allowed. Tell you what, Sinjir. I'll offer a bonus. I have 2 tasks at hand, and if you say yes right now, you get to choose which one you do and which one goes to my other advisor, Oxy.
What are these tasks?
She waggles a metronome finger.
Not until you say yes.
Fine. Yes.
Her small smile grows by 1, maybe 2 microns. And Mon Mothma says,
Splendid. The first task is shopping.
Shopping? Did I hear you right?
Yes. Do you know what to buy for a newborn baby? After all, our dear friend Leia is expecting.
Sinjir makes a face like he just sniffed a diaper.
Whiskey?
That would be better for the mother and father, I suspect. No, not whiskey. Perhaps you shouldn't be buying baby gifts.
He puckers his lips.
And maybe you should not relegate this personal, intimate task to a mere advisor.
Yes. Well, let's try the second task. I need someone to deliver a gift to the senator from Orish, Tolwar Wartol. An apology of sorts.
An apology? Stars forfend.
Why? The Chancellor sighs. He apparently wasn't malevolently opposing my vote and manipulating senators directly.
Yes, he just failed to help the gears of democracy turn. And he's running against you. He's your opponent, Chancellor.
One does not blame a Tuka for toying with a mouse. He is who he is. And so I thought it necessary to deliver a small gift to apologize for my little ploy on his ship.
Gift delivery does not sound advisory to me, Chancellor.
Don't you even want to see the gift?
He says nothing, offering instead a dubious countenance. Mon clears her throat and lifts a small basket covered with a soft lavender cloth. She tells him to go on, have a look, and he does. It is a fruit basket, full of one kind of fruit, the pitta fruit. He cannot deny the smug smirk that tugs at his lips. Oh, Chancellor, and here I thought you said you had no sense of humor.
Perhaps there's a glimmer of one there. As you say, we share a crispness of wit, do we not?
I think we do.
So you'll deliver it?
I will.
Enjoy. And welcome to politics, Syngir Rathvelis.
Chapter 30. Jazz Amari's world lights up. Her teeth clamp against each other. Her jaw muscles are so tight, she fears they'll strain and snap. Then, it's over again. The wave of pain and light receding once more. She's left panting and wheezing on the floor of the Corellian shuttle as Mercurial Swift once again pulls the sparking baton away. He gives it a twirl. You skag, he hisses, his face scratched from her attack in Nima's temple by her head spurs, looms over her own. Behind him, Dengar lazes. Embo is at the other end of the shuttle's hold, sitting up straight and regarding the proceedings with all the interest and emotion of a coat rack. From the cockpit, the Rodian yells,
Swift, it's too dangerous. It's everywhere. Empire, the Republic, nowhere to go.
The disappointment on Swift's face is palpable.
Fine. Sit us down somewhere in the canyon.
Jazz rolls over. Every part of her feels like it's been stretched out so far, it won't go back to its original shape. Being electrocuted a handful of times is good at making you feel that way, as it turns out.
She gasps and manages to squeak out the words.
So, what's your plan, Swift?
Shut up.
No, really.
She groans.
What's the score? Clearance codes won't keep you safe in the middle of a war zone. Somebody will take a shot at us.
I don't have to explain myself to you.
No,
Dengar interjects.
But you might want to explain it to us. You know, your crew. You got a plan here, boss?
The way the barrel-chested Corellian says that last word, boss, she can tell it's not a term of great endearment.
Interesting.
Swift heels on the old bounty hunter, like he's about to lay into him. But he seems to cool down a little.
We'll park it for a while. Look for an opportunity to hit orbit and take our quarry back to Boss Gyuti on Nar Shaddaa. We just need to be patient.
He'll screw you all over,
Jazz says. Swift turns fast and drops a fist into her gut.
She curls up into herself like a bug.
Be quiet! Nothing's stopping me from taking you to Gyuti in 5 different sects.
He's just mad because you ruined his pretty looks,
Dengar says.
Shut it, Dengar!
Don't you...
Jazz winces as she sits up, her voice a keening wheeze.
Want to know what I'm doing here on Jakku? I could cut you in.
Another jam of the shock baton, this time against the side of her neck.
Her skull is a nest of stinging insects. She tries not to scream, but the scream comes anyway. A living thing that will not be contained. Then it's gone. Jazz topples over, whimpering.
I want to hear what she has to say,
Dengar notes.
I said shut it, Dengar.
Jazz blinks, and in the time it takes to do that, she hears the clatter-clack of a blaster being cocked. When her vision returns, she sees Dengar has his rifle up over his knee and pointed right at Swift's middle.
I don't feel like shutting it, you smug git. I got a right to talk to the girl. Me and her auntie knew each other. I owe her a convo. Go on, Jesse.
I'm hunting someone here.
Who's that now?
Reslon.
She's nobody, Swift says. Sloan was the top of the food chain, but that day is over. Now she's nothing.
Jazz offers a half-hearted shrug.
Not to the New Republic. They want her bad. And they're willing to pay for her, served up to them on a plate. She knows things. She's the key. Or so they believe. I don't even care if they're right. What I care is what they're paying me. And it's a lot.
All that is a lie. But despite the glib saying, the truth will most certainly not set her free.
How much are they paying?
That question asked by Embo, spoken in the Cayuso tongue. She hates to lie to him. Really, she does. But she does it anyway.
1,000,000.
Eyes go big as battle stations. Dengar whistles.
Lot of money for one girl. Still, working for the New Republic ain't exactly cozy making, is it?
It is when they offer you full pardons.
And that is the statement that vacuums the air from the cabin. They're all left in shock by that offer. A pardon has meaning. They each have a list of criminal sins longer than a hut slug's tail. And with the galaxy shifting as it is toward the New Republic, the day will come sooner than later when bounty hunters are forced to flee to the fringes if they don't want to get swept up and locked away. The tension in the ship rises. Jazz seizes it. She goes on.
You work with me? I cut you in. You all get full pardons. Embo, Dengar, you both worked with Sugi. Maybe there's something to be said for a little tradition, isn't there?
They won't leave me,
Swift protests with a vulpine stare.
They know their place. Won't do them any good to betray Guti and make enemies of Black Sun. They'll stay with me.
You forgot one part,
Dengar says. Mercurial raises an eyebrow.
What?
We don't really like you.
The old bounty hunter clubs Swift in the side of his head with his blaster. The pretty boy collapses next to her, but he's not content to go down quietly. Oh no. Swift moves fast, getting behind her and pulling his forearm against her windpipe. With the back of his heel, he kicks out and opens the side of the shuttle. The wall lifts, the ramp descends, and the brightness of the Jakku sun fills the cabin, nearly blinding them all. He backs Jazz toward the door, using her as cover.
You could have all been rich, he seethes.
Dengar has his rifle pointed, but can't get a shot. Embo stands, but seems casually disinterested in the events. She knows that look. It's not disinterest she sees. Rather, it's a look that says he trusts her to handle this.
You forgot one thing,
she says, as Swift's arm tightens.
I forgot nothing,
he snarls in her ear.
You forgot that I didn't remove all my horns, idiot.
Grunt. She slams her head backward into his face. Her thorn-shaped horns dig into the meat of his other cheek, and Swift howls. And for the hair's breadth of a moment, he relaxes his grip on her throat. Jazz moves fast. She slides free like a man slipping a noose, then ducks quickly and kicks out with a hard foot. It catches Swift right in the middle. And the bounty hunter sails out the now open door of the shuttle. Panting, Jazz slams her heel against the button, and again the ramp ascends as the door closes. She rubs her eyes and collapses against the wall, weary. Dengar is looking at her with both surprise and satisfaction on his face. He gives her a curt nod.
Nicely done, Jazzy.
Embo nods too. In Cayuso,
I am glad it turned out this way.
The Rhodian, whose name she doesn't even yet know, calls back,
"What's going on back there?"
Jazz winces.
Is she loyal?
Oh, Jeter? Not to Swift she isn't.
Then I guess I have a new crew,
Jazz says. Dengar offers a sloppy smile and a wink.
Guess you do, love.
Interlude. Cloud City. Bespin.
Lobot, we're home.
Lando lifts a dubious eyebrow as he looks around, exasperated.
Guess the Empire didn't keep up with housekeeping.
This is the casino level. Game machines line the smooth, blue, alectite floors as far as the eye can see. Sabacc tables, too. And Pazak. And Jubilee wheels. Along the far wall are banks of holoprojectors meant to show the latest swoop race down on the track tubes piped through Bespin's toxic red zone atmosphere. Once, this was a shining pillar of gambling excess, classy and bright with light coming in through windows looking out over the sun-kissed clouds. Now, it's wrecked. Trash drifts and tumbles. Machines have been turned over, their credits cut from inside like food from a beast's belly. The windows are covered over with metal. The holoprojectors are dark. Lobot steps up alongside Lando. The computer forming a half-moon around the back of the man's bald head blinks and pulses, and at Lando's wrist is a communication from his friend and cohort.
I'll look into rehiring staff immediately.
Do that, Lando says. Then he thrusts up a finger. But make sure we're hiring some refugees, will you?
The galaxy's like a cup that's been knocked over, and now everything's spilling out. Whole worlds have been displaced by the war. Lando can't let Cloud City turn from being a city of luxury to being a tent city of expats and evacuees, but he can damn sure give those people jobs. That's his favorite kind of arrangement. The kind where everybody gets something for their trouble. They win, he wins. The ideal for how everything should work. Cloud City was always that for Calrissian. It was a respite, a refuge from the Empire, while at the same time not existing to spite the Empire either.
He thought, hey, everybody can be happy, baby.
The Empire didn't have to care. The rebels didn't need to care. Cloud City could hang in the air above Bespin, separate from all the chaos, from all the strife. Come here. Taste a little luxury. Meanwhile, he could mine the Tabana gas, sell it to whatever starship manufacturer wanted it. The stuff was perfect for making hyperdrives, because with Tabana, a little went a long way. Meanwhile, Lando could sit back, have a drink, roll some dice, find a lady, or three. Yeah, it didn't work out that way. He knows now. In a war like this one, you don't get to be in the middle. You can't play both sides. He lived his whole life shooting right down the middle, never taking up a cause except the one that meant to support his own empty pockets. Those days are over. And so is his love of sweet neutrality. When Vader came here, everything changed. He lost Han for a time. He lost Lobot and Cloud City. He lost nearly everything. But he gained a little perspective. And he picked a damn side. Because sometimes, you want to win, you gotta bet big. You gotta put your stack of chits in one place. It paid off. The Empire is gone. And now, he's a hero of the Rebellion.
And oh, you can be sure he used that to con more than his fair share of free drinks, not to mention the attention of beautiful admirers.
But all he wants is his city back. After Endor, he thought he would just be able to sweep in here like a handsome king, retaking his throne in the sky. But then that son of a slug, Governor Adelhard, formed the Iron Blockade. He kept the people here trapped, not only by a well-organized Imperial remnant, but also by a grand lie. that Palpatine was not dead. And Lando knows that old shriveled Cenobite is dead, because he's the one who took out the Death Star's reactor core. And because Luke said the monster was dead.
Can you believe it? Palpatine and Vader, both gone. Two scourges scoured from the galaxy.
Suddenly he had a second war to fight. Here he thought the Empire was done for, and Cloud City was once again his.
What an eager fool.
Nothing's ever that simple, is it? It took months and months. He had to stage an uprising. Had to interface with Lobot on the inside. Had to cash in favors with a handful of scoundrels, like Kars Tal Korla, that pirate. All because the New Republic wouldn't commit a military action to retaking the city. He respects it, he understands it, and Leia put it best when she said,
"The rebellion was easy, Lando. Governing's harder."
The Chancellor was just trying to hold on to whatever advantage she had. And then with the Liberation Day attack on Chandrilla, well, all that is over and done. No need to dwell. Cloud City is his once again. Lando starved out Adelhard. Most of the Imperials surrendered. It's over. Thank the lucky stars. He steps forward into the casino level, and he and Lobot aren't alone. He's got a ragtag force with him. Some of his wing guard security forces, but some New Republic soldiers too. It's just enough to perform cleanup on those who linger behind, clinging to the illusion they can still win this thing. Together they march forward through the wreckage of the casino level. He asks Lobot,
"The holdouts are ahead?"
"Yes, in the Bola Tonga room."
"Fine, fine. Let's get this over with and evict our final tenants."
As they walk, Lobot looks over at him as a new communication flashes across his wrist.
"I am told to remind you that the princess will soon give birth, and you have not yet procured for them the standard natal gift."
"What? That's impossible. She was just..." "I swear, they just got married. Didn't I just get them a nuptial gift?"
"It has been the proper biological time. You just do not realize how much time has passed. We have been busy."
"So have they, I guess."
"Also, you never got them a nuptial gift."
He sighs.
"Okay, okay. Buying gifts for a kid. Can we get him a cute little cape and a mustache so he looks like old Uncle Lando?"
Lobot doesn't respond, offering only a humorless stare.
"Fine, fine, I'll think about it."
His mind drifts briefly to Han and Leia. Han, one of his oldest and greatest friends. And sure, one of his greatest rivals, too. He misses that old reprobate.
The crazy times they had.
Good times, even when they were bad. And now Han is with Leia.
Whew, boy. Those two are a pair of rocket boosters firing full bore.
Lando just hopes those two engines are both firing in the same direction. Because if they're ever pointed at each other, they'll burn each other up.
"We're here."
That from Lobot. Ahead waits the door to the Bolo Tonga room. Lando can see it's been sealed with mag alloy. He turns to Captain Gladstone of the Wing Guard.
"We got imaging?"
Gladstone nods.
"They're holed up in there. They've broken through to the beam outtake shaft, which in theory would lead them to the engineering sublayer."
"But the fumes coming up through the shaft will kill them if they try."
"That's exactly it, Baron Administrator."
"So they're trapped?"
"Like creep bugs in a beetle bag."
"All right, let's open it up."
"No, you know, wait.
Can they hear me through that door?"
"They can if you get close."
Lando nods, pulling his blaster. It's a fancy-looking piece of work from back when they put a little art into their design. It's a Rossmoyne vitiator pistol, a bolt thrower from a more elegant age. Lando won it recently in a game of six-card Gizga Limit from a spice-drunk Iberian diplomat. Every Rossmoyne that came off the line was engraved by hand, with scroll work by artisans from the original family. The grip in particular shows these wonderful whorls and curves, like a spiraling maze you could follow with a blind fingertip. Maybe with the Empire gone, Kraft's beings will return to the galaxy, and with it, their beauty. That's later. For now, he taps on the door with the vitiator.
Hello? This is Lando Calrissian,
he says loudly so they can hear him.
I'm Baron Administrator of Cloud City, not to mention Hero of the Rebellion. I suspect you've heard of me. Can you hear me all right? Tap on the door if you can.
Nothing. But then, three taps. Good enough. He keeps talking, putting a little extra smooth in his voice to keep them calm, to keep them listening.
Here's how this is gonna go. I'm a gambling man, and so I'm gonna bet that you're in there hungry and scared and feeling like people without a country. And you are, because by now I'm sure you heard Adelhard's story about Palpatine being alive was a big old nasty lie. I'm gonna take that bet, and I'm gonna say you'd be fine, just fine with dropping your weapons so we can open up this door, escort you out, and get you a hot meal and a warm bed. I'm not interested in prosecuting you. Not gonna throw you into some New Republic dungeon. I'll even put my blaster away, so when I walk inside, you know how serious I am about this. Tap if you hear me. Good.
He steps away, tucking his blaster into the holster at his hip. Lando signals to Gladstone.
Unseal it.
The Wingard engineers get to work, crouching on each side of it, blast masks over their eyes as they ignite plasma lances to burn through the line of puffy metal alloy sealing the door. Sparks sear lines in the air. And then, it's done. Two engineers stand by the door, one on each side. They use the lever ends of their lances to jack the door. It falls hard in Lando's direction, and he gently steps aside as it hits the floor. A puff of smoke and a whirl of embers follow. Lando knows that a hail of lasers might come sizzling out of that doorway and cut him to pieces. But he also knows that whoever is in there realizes they'll get cut to pieces in return. No hot meal, no warm bed, just body bags for each of them. As the smoke clears, he sees the Imperial men and women in there, hands on their heads, blasters at their feet. Lando laughs and urges them out of the Bolotanga room. They look scared and tired, each of them thin-cheeked with dry lips and bloodshot eyes.
Come on, let's go. It's okay. It's over. You made the right choice.
A few dozen of them come out, taken into custody by the Wingard. The New Republic soldiers stand back. Then Gladstone says,
The Baron Administrator, sir?
A note of worry in his voice. He gestures into the room. Lando steps in, blaster still at his hip. One holdout remains inside the Bolotanga room. All the way on the other side of the card table, where the dealer would normally stand. It's a broad-chested fellow, with only two pieces of armor on. A black chest plate and a white trooper helmet. He's standing up against the back wall. A rifle is in his hand. The barrel of the rifle is pointed at the ground. Which either means he's not sure what to do yet, or he's been waiting for this moment.
Let me guess, Lando says. You're the commander.
A pause before the man says, Sergeant.
The last sergeant. Sergeant. Everyone else has surrendered or died. Adelhard's out. And the Empire isn't looking good as an option anywhere, big fella. So that's the deal. You surrender, or it goes the other way.
The rifle hangs. The man doesn't put it down. And his hand isn't shaking.
It's gonna go the other way.
It happens fast.
Long live the Empire!
The Imperial swings the rifle up. It never fires. The sergeant drops as a single shot from Lando's vitiator punctures his armor and pierces his heart. The rifle never leaves the soldier's hand. His body just slumps atop it. Lando tucks the blaster back in its holster. His heart pulses in his chest. A mad thrill goes through him as he thinks,
I still got it.
And that fool was betting that Lando was too slow, and his weapon wouldn't clear the holster, and couldn't punch through that armor if it did. Wrong on both counts.
Win some, lose some, Lando says, clucking his tongue.
He saunters over to the dead man, grabs the black-lensed helmet from underneath, and pries it off. The sergeant is a square-jawed man, with a brow like a rocky outcropping. Tough mug, but not tough enough.
Hey now,
Lando says, spinning the helmet in his hand. He looks to Lobot.
I got an idea. Every kid needs a lamp, right? Like a nightlight? Can we get the engineers to turn this into a lamp? It'd be something special, don't you think?
Lobot signals across the communicator.
No.
Yeah, okay. That's a compelling argument, Lando says, chuckling.
He stands up, tossing the helmet from hand to hand before dropping it to the ground.
Still, kid's gotta see what his parents fought for. And I suspect, given his parents, he's gonna do some fighting himself.
That's when Lando gets an idea. He again draws the blaster, gives it a spin in his hand.
Kid's gonna get into trouble one day.
Every kid does, but with the blood of a scoundrel and a princess in his veins, his defiance will shake the stars.
He's gonna need some help, and that's where Uncle Lando comes in.
Lando holds up the weapon, admiring it. At his wrist, Lobot protests.
We are not giving a blaster to the boy. Children should not play with blasters.
Lobot's face is stern.
No, not for now. For later, when the time is right. Tell you what, I'll write a note. Kind of a, hey kid, it's me, Uncle Lando. You ever need help and don't want to call your father? Come find me. We'll sort it out. Put that in with the blaster, then secure it on a locker here on Cloud City, and give Han the key. Don't tell him what's in it. He'll pitch a fit if he sees it. It'll be for the boy when he's older.
That fails to provide them with a gift now, Lando.
He tosses the blaster to Lobot, who catches it awkwardly, then returns a dour look. Lando rolls his eyes.
Fine, fine. Send them something else, too. What do we have?
Oh, I know.
We got that Ventilian catamaran in the Western skip dock. Give them that ship. They can take it out on, hey, I don't know, family cruises or something.
Lobot nods. One word across the communicator.
Acceptable.
Can you believe it?
Lando asks.
Han and Leia. A family. Times are changing. You think I should start a family?
One more word.
No.
He laughs.
Once again, my friend, we agree. Let's go get a drink.
I don't drink.
Lando puts his arm around Lobot's stiff shoulders.
I know. It's all right. I'll have two to make it equitable. That way we both win.
Chapter 31. Ray Sloane has given up and given in. Gallius Rax has left her here with a front row seat for what may very well be the last battle of this war. Because even if the Empire wins Jakku, then what? The Empire that this world has borne is not her empire at all. It is a warped and twisted thing, sand scoured and gone to scrap. So she kneels. The burning in her legs has dimmed to a dull, numb ache. Her shoulders feel it too. Her hips, her neck, everything hurts. Her lips are dry. Her eyes feel like fruits left out too long in the sun. Worse, her side aches. Right where that damn woman, the pilot, popped her one back on Chandrilla. Every time she bothers to take a breath, it's like someone is slowly sawing a knife in and out of her ribs. She can't go anywhere. She and Brenton are on the roof. She pondered crawling to the edge of it and rolling off, if only to fall far enough to break her neck and end the misery. Meanwhile, Brenton is curled in upon himself, moaning and rolling around. Clearly, he's lost to madness. All the while, she watches the battle creep ever closer to the base. The Empire's line isn't breaking, but it's falling back. In the distance, she spies a mushroom plume of fire erupt from the top of a walker before it torturously topples over. Not far from that, an X-Wing, so far away it looks almost like a child's toy whipping about, clips its wing on a spire of rock and crashes into a DF-9 turret placement. Trooper bodies fly. In the sky, the two fleets rage against each other. It's hard to tell much of what's happening. The sun is so bright, it feels like it's about to set her corneas on fire. Best she can see is that the Imperial fleet is holding firm. The Republic ships aren't making a dent. Not yet. But she fears they will. It's inevitable. Soon it'll come here, to the base. That's what Rax wants. Not only does she get to sit here and watch it all collapse, she'll be underneath it when it does. When the base goes, she'll go too. Maybe captured. Probably dead. And Rax will get away. But to where? And why? It's his endgame she can't figure out. All of this is a show. It's in service to something. And that place he was protecting out in the valley, near the plaintive hand, it means something. Not that it matters. He's gone. She remains. Sloane laughs, then weeps, then bows her head like a penitent monk. Ah! Brenton cries out suddenly. He rolls over, arching his back and baring his teeth to the sky. Pain seems to cross his face. Suddenly a wave of energy pulses the air, causing all the hairs on her arms and neck to stiffen. Brenton stands up, shaking his hands. The two cuffs around his wrist drop away. She looks at him, astonished. You're free.
And you're next.
He bends down, scooping something into his open hands, talking as he does.
You ever notice how dirty this planet is? I don't just mean it like every planet is dirty. I mean it's so dry, so desiccated. Everything erodes to dust. Dust picked up on the wind and blown everywhere. Like here.
He shows her his hands, which are now piled with little puffs of brown and rust-colored dust. Then he gets behind her and begins massaging the dust right into the cuffs.
What are you doing?
Rebels like me, we get trained on how to escape all kinds of situations. Magna cuffs are hard to beat, but not impossible.
Long as you can get something in between the magnetic couplings. In this case...
Another pulse of energy as the cuffs fall from her wrists.
The dust of Jakku.
I'm free, she thinks. You're something, Brenton Wexley.
She knows now that her instincts to preserve his life were right.
We rebels had to stay ahead of you Imperials somehow.
We need to move fast, she says. Find a ship. Intercept Rax.
You think he's going back to the valley?
It's our only shot. Something's going on here. Something big that I don't understand.
Even if he's not there, whatever he's hiding will be the key to understanding it all.
Come on!
Sloane moves with long strides, ignoring the pain in her side, in her legs, in her throat. She pushes away her dehydration, pretending it just doesn't exist. As she finds the turbo lift down, she already begins to formulate a plan in her head. They're going to need a ship. Going overland won't do. Too slow. and the battle raging here will make traversing the surface of Jakku an untenable prospect. That means they need to be airborne in something fast. A TIE could work because it's fast, nimble, versatile. Good news is, they've got plenty of Imperial starfighters here. An automatic belt-fed line of them set up for fueling, launch, landing, and refueling. Churn and burn. Fighters, interceptors, bombers, strikers. Move them up and out. Get them flying. The lift hums downward. It dings open. They step out and see a dust-swept hallway. It's empty. The base is like a tomb. Dirt-caked and filthy. And quiet as the grave, too. Abandoned already? Sloane wonders. Or is it just that the entire breadth and depth of the Imperial forces are already out there, fighting tooth and nail against the New Republic incursion? She suspects the latter. All the pieces have been pushed out onto the game board.
None are in reserve.
Rax is betting the Empire. All or nothing. A mouse droid wheels past, blurping and squeaking as it rounds the corner. It's the only sign of life they see. That is, until they round the same corner. The mouse droid comes squealing back, zipping through Sloane's legs. There's a moment of distraction as she dances out of its way, and when she turns back around, she's face to face with an Imperial officer. Non-com black, small hat askew. The bars on the woman's chest indicate she's a prison warden. Which doesn't make any sense because...
Nora, Brenton says.
You,
Sloane says to the woman. A blaster thrusts up into Sloane's face.
Yes, me.
Nora came out of a docking bay along the side, finding a base mostly empty. No troopers, only droids and a few officers pecking about. At the time, she thought...
This is it. This is the end of the Empire. They just don't know it yet.
And strange as it is, a sense of hopelessness settled over her. And with it, a feeling of lost purpose. The Empire had been her enemy for so long. What happens when it's gone? It's like putting out a fire by sucking all the oxygen out of the room. The fire's gone, but now how do you breathe? She had to put that aside, though. Because as she reminded herself, she still had a purpose. Find her husband. Find Sloane. And one minute she's wandering the labyrinthine base, stepping past an abandoned, gutted supply room, and the next she's rounding the corner and meeting her quarry face to face. It takes her a second to recognize Sloane. It takes her even longer to register her husband saying her name. Next thing she knows... She's got her blaster pistol up and pointed right in Sloane's face. Instantly, she wants to pull the trigger and vacate the woman's brains from her skull. A surge of anger geysers up inside her like a sprout of corrosive acid. No justice, only revenge. But Brenton steadies her hand.
Nora,
no.
Brenton, she says, the name spoken not happily, but with trepidation and grief.
Get your hand off me! Why are you here? Why are you with her?
Paranoia unspools inside Nora's mind. She fears suddenly that he's still programmed, still enslaved to the chip embedded in his brainstem. Bones takes the cue and grabs his wrist, twisting it so hard he cries out in pain. The droid smashes her husband against the wall.
You hurt Tamin!
The heavily modified B-1 droid begins to bend the arm back farther, 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 until Nora can hear the bones creaking and straining.
Bones,
she says with a reluctant admonition.
Stop! Just hold him.
Nora!
Brenton pleads.
I'm not with the Empire. I didn't mean to do those things. Is our son okay?
Sloane, with her hands up, says...
He's right. He was made to do it.
Shut your mouth! Nora hisses at her.
Both of you! Be quiet! We don't have time for a conversation. What's going to happen is we're going back to my ship. We are getting out of here, and soon as we have a window, I'm taking you both back to Chandrilla.
It's not me you want, Sloane says.
Nora, she's right.
Quiet, Grand Admiral. Look at me. Do I look like an admiral anymore? I'm sneaking around an Imperial base with a rebel. Nora, don't be an idiot.
At that word, Bones extends his other arm, the one not poised to break Brenton's limb, and extends his concealed vibroblade. It thrusts up under Sloane's chin. It nicks the skin. A bead of blood swells up like a little balloon.
Oh, I'm sorry for calling you an idiot, but there's more going on here.
Nora, please, listen to her.
Sloane continues.
A man named Rax. He's in charge of the Empire. He's the one who put a chip in your husband's head. He's the one who set up the attack on Liberation Day. I was just a...
Sloane cringes as if this is hard for her to admit.
I was just a distraction. He's the puppeteer. There's something out beyond Nima's canyons and caverns. A valley. Rax is protecting something there. Take me there. We can finish this.
Indecision wars inside Nora's heart. She wants to shoot Sloane right in the chest, or club her in the head, or drag her by the hair back to the shuttle. She wants to kiss her husband, and kill him, and throttle him to ask him why, and apologize for leaving him behind, and pretend like none of this ever happened, and that she and her son and her man are still back on Akiva, living their best life. Nora tells herself, Sloane is lying. The woman is a practiced deceiver, and Brenton is on the leash of whatever control chip she hammered into his head. And yet she's clearly right. Sloane is no Grand Admiral anymore. She was brought here as a prisoner. The Empire no longer calls Rae Sloane its leader, or even its daughter. What if she's right? What if that man, Rax, is the answer to everything? Nora tells herself,
I don't have to care about that. I can do the job I was brought here to do.
Capture Sloane, save her husband, and go home. But what if that doesn't fix anything? What if Nora has a chance, one chance, to stop the real monster behind the scenes? What if this Rax is really the puppet master Sloane claims he is? Can Nora just let him go?
Let's go,
she says.
Nora, wait!
You better be right about this Rax, Nora says. Because if I find out you're wrong, or that you're playing me, I'll have my droid here break every centimeter of every bone in your bodies. Are we clear?
Sloane grins.
Clear as the blue sky, Nora Wexley.
Part 5. Interlude. The Imperialis, 25 years ago.
It is the first time Galley has been off Jakku in 10 years, and only the second time ever, at least as far as he can remember. He does not know who his parents are or where they came from. Sometimes he imagines that they came from some faraway place, a place of rivers and forests, a place with a sea. Other times he is angry at them, and he thinks,
who my parents are does not matter.
They aren't my everything. They aren't my anything.
He envisions in these times of anger that they are dirt merchants or sand farmers from Jakku, and it will be his great pleasure to transcend them. It is far more likely that they are dead. Now he sits in a plush room, more opulent than anything he's ever seen before. This is the same ship as the last time he left Jakku, but this time he is no stowaway. This is not some cargo space in which he hides. He sits on a chair. It is the most comfortable chair he has ever sat in. He wants to live in this chair. He may be fine dying in this chair. And dying on this chair may in fact be what awaits him. The man to whom this ship belongs, a man named Sheev Palpatine, is a cipher. Galley has only met him once ever, but the man has haunted his dreams since. Those dark robes.